Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm your host for Funny Stuff, half an hour of comedy, which airs every Friday night here on KCRW. And for the last 2 weeks, we have been listening to an interview with Peter Cook, which has been liberally spiced with some excerpts from his work. And we took him up through Beyond the Fringe and into the television work that he's done with Peter, with Dudley Moore. And that's what we're going to start off with this week. It's a piece, one of the Pete and Dud routines. These were two characters that they used to sort of semi-improvise. They would start off by improvising into a tape recorder and then get a transcript and edit it down from there. But basically, when they went to do these pieces, they would take off from there. And they were, so we'll call them semi-improvisational. But they're wonderful pieces of material. And then from there, we'll talk about the infamous Derek and Clive stuff and the show Good Evening and what else Peter Cook has been up to. So stay tuned, sit down, enjoy yourself, and let's continue on with one of the great Pete and Dud routines by Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Come in here, Margaret, would you please?
Here. You've been ferreting around in my sandwich box, haven't you?
I certainly have, and I found something not altogether connected with sandwiches. I refer, of course, to Blauvetter's Encyclopedia of Sexual Knowledge. How do you explain this?
I found it on the heath, Pete, and I thought I'd better keep in my sandwich to keep it dry, you know, until someone claimed it.
You've been hiding it away, aren't you, because you're ashamed of it?
No, I haven't. I just kept it there for safekeeping.
You shouldn't be ashamed of sex, Dad. It's no good hiding your sex away in your sandwich tin. That won't do any good. Bring it out in the open.
Yeah. It's a good book, though. Some good bits in it. Have you read anything?
I've been through it up to page 3001.
Well, you've read the whole lot then, haven't you?
Yes, it's quite good, isn't it?
I like it, because it tells you everything about sex from the word go, doesn't it?
Well,
I
mean, it's a wonderful thing about a sexual mores throughout the ages, Dad.
And it shows you humans' sexual endeavour from the time of Adam and Eve, Pete.
It certainly does. All the myths about it as well. Mm. Of course, Adam and Eve, while they were in the Garden of Eden, they didn't have anything to do with sex to start with, you know. When they were in paradise, they didn't have anything to do with sex. Because they were wandering around naked, but they didn't know they were naked.
I bet they did know. I mean, you soon know once you get caught up on the brambles, wouldn't you?
They had no idea. They were remarkably stupid as well as naked, and they didn't know they were naked till up came the servant. Or no, rather the serpent.
Serpent, yeah.
Well, serpent in servant's guise, as some authorities have it. Yeah. Up came the serpent and said, "Here's an apple. Lay your teeth into that." And then they lay their teeth in the apple, and then the serpent said, "You're nude. You're completely nude."
Hello, nudies.
Hello, nudies.
Of course, they dashed off into the brush and covered themselves with embarrassment, didn't they?
And, of course, mulberry leaves as well. They covered themselves altogether with this primitive clothing made of leaves. And suddenly, as soon as they become completely covered, they began to get attracted to each other. And then, of course, they tore off the mulberry leaves and it all started, the whole business.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, once you get clothes on, you're more attracted to other people. Like, I think Aunt Dolly's more attracted with clothes on than off. So Uncle Bert says, anyway.
Yes, well, Aunt Dolly is really at her most attractive when she's completely covered in wool and has a black veil over her. And ideally, she should be in another room from you.
But who is your sort of ideal woman, Pete?
Well, above all others, I covet the elfin beauty. The gazelle slim elfin beauty. Very slim, very slender, but all the same, still being endowed with a certain amount of
busty substances.
Yes. A kind of Audrey Hepburn with Jane Mansfield overtones. I go for.
Well,
what do you like?
Me too, the same sort of thing. But actually, I like the sort of woman who throws herself on you and tears your clothes off with rancid sensuality.
Yes, they're quite good, aren't they? I think you're referring to rampant sensuality.
Well, either one will do. And, of course, the important thing is that they tear your clothes off.
Yes, that's the chief thing, whether it's rampant. I like a good rampant woman.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, a rampant woman or rancid, whichever you prefer, that was Veronica Pilbrow.
Oh, goodness, yes, I remember her.
Do I remember her?
Yeah.
She always used to for ourselves on Roger Braintree. Never me, though.
Yeah, well, Roger Braintree at school, he always knew much more than everyone else, didn't he? He's always boasting about the things he knew much more than anyone else.
Oh, clever draws, wasn't he? Eh?
Yeah. Remember that time he come round behind the wooden buildings?
Yeah.
And he had, what was his name?
Kenny Vare
with him. And yeah. He come up and told me, he said, I've discovered the most disgusting word in the world. It's so filthy that no one's allowed to see it except bishops. And nobody knows what it means. It's the worst word in the world.
What was the word?
Well, he wouldn't tell me. I had to give him half a pound of peppermints before he let it out. Do you know what it was?
What?
Bastard. Bastard.
What's that mean, Pete?
Well, he wouldn't tell me, so I knew it was filthy, but I didn't know how to use it. So he said the only place I could see it was down at the town hall in the enormous dictionary. They have the enormous one with a whole volume to each letter. And you can only get in with a medical certificate. So I went down there and sneaked in, you know, very secretively, and went up and I took down from the shelf this enormous, great, dusty bee and brought it down and opened it up, and there was the word in all its horror. Bastard.
What was the definition, Pete?
It said bastard. Child born out of wedlock.
What's a wedlock, Pete?
Wedlock, Dad, is a horrible thing. It's a mixture of a steam engine and a padlock. Some children are born out of them instead of the normal way, and it's the filthiest word in the world.
It'll make your hair drop out if you say it.
Oh, if you see that, yeah.
But I like looking words up in a dictionary. I like going down the balanced library, into the reference library, and getting out the Dictionary of Unconventional English out and looking up bloomers.
Yeah, quite a good way of spending an afternoon, I suppose.
Because I tell you what, Pete, actually, the whole business of sex is a bit of a letdown. Really, when you compare it with the wonderful romantic tales of the novelist who can portray sexual endeavours in so much better form.
Well, he makes it all so perfect. In the hands of a skilled novelist, sex becomes something which can never be attained in real life. Have you read Neville Shute?
Well, very little.
How much of Neville Shute have you read?
Nothing.
Yes, well, he has. Shute is a master of sensuality. He has some wonderful erotic passages. There's Town Like Alice, which is a wonderful book, in the hardcover version, page 81. If you go down the library, it falls open at that page. It's a description set in Australia, Dad. And there's this ash blonde girl, Tina.
And Tina, she... don't you be mean.
Shut up. She's standing on the runway, you see, of this aerodrome. And it's very hot, Australian bush heat, and very hot indeed. And she's standing there waiting for her rugged Aussie pilot to come, bronzed Tim Bradley. And it's very hot. The cicadas are rubbing their legs together and making that strange... very similar to that ghastly noise which is coming from your mouth at this very moment. And it's very hot and she's covered in dust. The Australian dust is all over her. She's got dust on her knees, dust on her shoulders.
Dust on her bust, Pete.
Dust on her bust, as you so rightly point out, Doug. And she's very dusty and very hot. Hot and dusty, and then suddenly, out of nowhere, the clouds open. There's a tremendous clap of thunder, and suddenly the mongoose is on her. Tropical rainstorm is soaking through the frail poplin she's wearing, and as the dress gets damper and damper, damper and damper, her wonderful frail form is outlined against the poplin. And then, what does she hear? But in the distance, she hears a distant buzzing of an approaching plane. She cups her ear like this to hear that...
She cups her perfectly proportioned upthrusting ear, Pete.
Horrible pink as well. Anyway, she cups it, and the plane comes down, goes on a runway, comes to a halt, and out comes the bronzed Aussie. But all the propellers are going very fast still. There's a tremendous rushing wind, and it blows up against her, and it blows the damp dress right up against her and reveals for all the world to see her perfectly defined...
Busty satin.
Busty.
What happens after that, Pete?
Well, the bronze pilot goes up to her and they walk away and the chapter ends in three dots.
What do three dots mean, Pete?
Well, in suit's hands, three dots can mean anything, but...
How's your father, perhaps?
Usually means a bit of that, but suit always uses three dots. It means use your own imagination. Yeah. That's what it means. Conjure the scene up yourself. Whenever I see dots, I feel all funny.
Well, it's put me in the mood to go up the Balanced Library and... look up bosom again.
No, it's no good looking up bosom. It only says, see bust.
Well, it's nice to read it all again, isn't
well,
it?
Well, it gives you something to do, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's lovely. Right.
We used to have various key moments written on cards, which would be incomprehensible to anybody else.
I'd love to see the card that said busty substances.
Busty substances.
I think that's one of the funniest phrases in the English language.
Busty substances. has to be said with great reverence and the spirit of holiness. There's something that's going... We often do get sort of carried away, as Dud and Pete, and add bits during the show. But they weren't improvised on the spot. They were pretty...
It's very frustrating to read about that show because it sounds just marvelous.
Terrific show.
And it has never been seen over here.
No, and, it is.
Then it was movie time and along came Bedazzled.
In 68, yes.
Which, to the best of my knowledge, is one of the few English films dubbed into English.
A lot of it was looped, and it peeved us both at the time because I thought we'd lost a great deal of performance in the... Mm-hmm. In the looping, it's got a sort of flat sound to it. I don't know why. I think it was just planes and...
Mm-hmm. But it's almost the entire film.
I hadn't thought of that for a while. I do remember. It's wonderful in Italian. I saw it in Rome. and it was like number one film in Italy because they're much more interested in religion. And I had the most beautiful voice in Italian, I thought. I thought it was a film of staggering profundity in Italian.
It's a wonderful script. It is a terrific script. I think that perhaps some of the production didn't do the script justice because I think it's a wonderful, wonderful script.
I thought it was a little slow moving. Both our performances a bit wooden.
Well, you weren't used to performing in the film sort of stuff.
I think we may have well have been a little bit overawed by being in a film, but I give tremendous credit to Stanley Donen because... he really put up the money for it.
Didn't he turn down some major movie to do it?
He turned down like Hello Dolly or something. I mean, his salary for doing whatever he didn't do is about the budget of the Bedazzled. Well, and I worked with him on the script, and he was very good to work with. He was actually very, very sensible in terms of just editing and so on material.
What went on between Bedazzled and Behind the Fridge?
Oh, he did some more. I mean, we were doing television. We did... three series of Not Only But Also, and Behind the Fridge was 70 something. Mm-hmm. Started off in Australia and came to London where it was still Behind the Fridge, and then became Good Evening when it got to Broadway.
Was it the same show?
No, it was a very lazy show in Australia, very self-indulgent, and quite a lazy show in London, and Alex Cohen forced us to make it a better show for Broadway.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm terribly well, and you?
I'm terribly well as well.
God, I must say you're looking awfully fit.
Well, I'm feeling pretty fit, actually.
Yes.
Isn't it amazing us bumping into each other like this?
Yes, I'm in here of all places.
Here of all places? I mean, I haven't seen you since...
Oh, God, hold on a second.
When was it?
God, we haven't seen each other...
Oh, God.
Well, we haven't seen each other... before.
That's right, we've never ever seen each other before, have we?
Yeah.
You've never seen me.
And I've never seen you. What a small world.
What a small world.
God, it's the last thing I expected.
Well, it must be about a million to one chance.
Oh, more than that.
Do you think so?
Yes, a couple of billion to one.
A couple of billion and a half, possibly.
Yes, probably 3 billion to 1, the way the world's going.
Yes, they're breeding like rabbits, aren't they?
Yes. Anyway, it's awfully nice to see you.
Well, it's terribly nice to see you.
Yes. Tell me, are you still doing whatever you have been doing? That is, of course, if you ever do anything.
Oh, yes, I'm still with the old firm, you know.
The old firm?
Yes, soldiering on. Just been made a director, in fact.
Oh, congratulations.
Well, under somewhat tragic circumstances, I stepped into poor old Bender's shoes. Did you know Bender?
Bender. The name certainly doesn't ring a bell. Bender who?
Bender Harrison.
Oh, Bender Harrison, yeah. No, I've never heard of him.
You never will now, poor chap. He died last week.
God, so poor old Bender's dead.
Completely dead.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I had no idea.
Well, nor did Bender, really. He sort of keeled over at the office party.
Oh, God.
Mind you, knowing Bender the way I knew Bender, which was pretty well. I think that's the way he would have wanted to go.
Well, you knowing Bender the way you must have known Bender, I'm sure that's the way he must have wanted to go.
Yes.
Not much point lingering on.
No, he was 106.
Oh.
Anyway, look, terribly nice to see you. I really ought to be dashing back to the office. You know, time waits for no man.
Yes, ought to be toddling along myself.
And do remember me to,
Vera.
You must forgive me. I'm terribly bad at names. Keep forgetting them.
That's quite all right.
Do remember me to,
Vera.
That's the chap.
Yes.
And jolly good luck with it.
Yes, well, and the same to you. And look, we must keep in touch.
Absolutely. Look, I'll give you a tinkle.
Or vice versa.
Yes, we must do this again.
Yes.
Goodbye.
We did Broadway, then we toured for a long time, and our last stop was Los Angeles, by which time the show had become chaos again. By the time we got Los Angeles, it was the only place where we got one bad review, and we fully deserved it, because we'd done it for so long, the show. We'd put in all these private jokes, which made no sense to the audience whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
We made the show longer, which is counterproductive, because we wanted to do it in shorter time. And Dudley stayed on, got married to Tuesday World. And I went back to England. And then Michael White sort of put us together with Paul Morrissey. And we wrote this script. It was quite a funny script. There were a few scenes in Howard the Baskervilles which I think are very funny. But we could never resolve how to do it with Paul, who I found such a funny guy.
Somehow seeing Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson doing One Leg Too Few just somehow...
Well, it wasn't right.
It jars.
Well, that... I mean, we connived at it, but Paul would go through transcripts of things we'd done and say, well, that'll work. I'll put that there. And I think we started the film in a mood of exhaustion. We'd have been battling over the script. We should have abandoned it, but we didn't.
Now, around this time... There cropped up an international phenomenon called Monty Python.
Right.
How did you feel, sort of semi-inactive and not really a part of what was going on then, seeing their huge success?
Oh, God, I'm so pleased to have something funny on television. I'm delighted for anything funny to get on television. There isn't much. And that was wonderful.
Did you know them at that point?
I'd met John, I'd met Graham Chapman. And John had, in fact, been in some establishment cast at some time or other.
Hmm.
And when Monty Python came on, the first series, it didn't go down well at all. There's this notion that Monty Python appeared and was received with rapture.
Well, they aired it at some bizarre time, and
yes,
they kept changing the time.
Listen to the audience responses. Sort of puzzled humming rather than laughter and applause. But thank God they then repeated it and it then got a bigger audience. And well, then went on for however long it went on. I'm one of those terrible people who wish people to stick in time exactly where they were. I've never forgiven James Garner for stopping doing the Rockford Files, because I want the Rockford Files on every week. Yeah. And the fact that James Garner doesn't want to do it anymore, it means nothing to me as a member of the public.
Well, most of the public feels that way about you.
Well, sod the public. I'm about the laziest person I know in the world.
At least in this country, a bunch of us saw you in a television program called The Two of Us.
That was pure coincidence. I was over here doing a charity show of some kind. I don't want to give the impression I do many of these charity shows. I've about one every decade. But for some reason, I was over here. I was staying up with friends in Benedict Canyon and had one of Los Angeles' periodic floods where all the canyons turn into rivers and people float down. And a script came up for a pilot of The Two of Us. And would I consider doing it? And so I rafted down to the CBS or wherever it had been done. Then I rang round. I had a very short time to make up my mind. I rang round and said, what are the chances of the pilot actually going to series? And it was about, it seemed to be about 500 to 1. And I thought, oh, I'll do this pilot, I'll pick up the money, and my charity work has been rewarded, and go home. That's the last I'll hear of it. And I was wrong. It did get picked up, and I did it. Well, I mean, as you know, once you've signed to do a pilot, you're signed away for as long as it runs.
Yeah.
I really didn't, not on the basis of reading the script and thinking this will never work. It was just on the number of pilots made to those that go to series. The pilot script was very good, and about 6 months later, I was back in LA doing it. I didn't see it all that much because it clashed with Monday Night Football. we started off being a sort of rating success, and then, surprise, surprise, Monday Night Football came on and we were wiped out.
Were you happy doing it?
Nice cast, nice people writing it. A perfectly pleasant way of spending 6 months, but not anything I'd anticipated doing.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'll ever do a pilot again. I just did a pilot with Graham Chapman.
Which I have seen, and I think is a terrific little show.
Oh, you've seen it, have you?
Yes.
He's very good as the Queen.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a recurring character in that. I mean, that is a pilot.
And Derek and Clive, we come to.
Oh, yeah, filthy. Derek and Clive, that came about feeling a bit bored in New York. And we just rented a studio and ad-libbed this filth. For our own amusement, had no intention of doing anything with it.
And this tape got passed around.
That's why we put out a record, because so many tapes went round.
And you weren't getting
rock and roll bands. I thought, well, if it's listened to so much, why not put it out? And I'm not ashamed of it or anything. But it was what it was, which is two people getting wrecked in New York one evening.
Oh, Tony.
Yeah.
Testing.
Testing. Oh, no, don't test any longer.
No.
I'll tell you the worst job I ever had.
What was that?
The worst job I ever had was with Jane Mansfield. You know, she's a fantastic bird, you know, big tits, huge bum and everything like that. But I had the terrible job of retrieving lobsters from her bum.
Really? Bloody hell, that must have been a task.
Well, it's quite a task because she had a big bum and they were lobsters.
I remember she had a huge bum.
Well, she had one and, you know, presumably in the afterlife, she still has one. And it was my job every evening to go round to Jane, who's a sweet girl.
Yeah.
Sweet, charming, shy, mysterious girl.
Yeah.
And get these lobsters out of her arsehole.
Yeah.
Which is so tricky because she was a very sensitive woman, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that lived on.
Lived on.
Two more records.
Two more records.
Ad nauseam.
Ad nauseam, Derek and Clive Come Again, which became Derek and Clive Get the Horn, the video.
Which has also, it was shown once here as part of the Filmex Festival.
That's right, yes.
And I didn't
get, for some reason it didn't get picked up for national distribution.
I didn't get to see that, and I still haven't seen it. It's great frustration. Is there to be any more Derek and Clive?
I don't think so. I mean, it's a nice way to make a record. I think Derek and Clive have explored about everything they can explore.
There's just so many orifices, right?
Yeah. But the whole notion arrived that, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore descend to filth. This is a sign of their waning talents.
Well, one thing
it's just a different thing to do.
Have those records sold well anywhere in the world?
Very well in England and Australia.
Truly wonderful stuff.
It's liberating filth.
Well, I have friends that they can rattle off the entire record.
I've seen people dancing to it in a bar in Fifth Avenue in New York at four in the morning.
Which cuts would they dance to?
I don't know, all the spoken tracks.
It says more about Fifth Avenue bars. During all the time you and Dudley were not performing together, you still were friends and maintained contact.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, it's not like there was
they came to England and vice versa.
Yeah, it wasn't a big breakup, right?
No. No, I was saying he stayed on in America and I went back to England.
Has there ever been a thought of doing another Peter Cook and Dudley Moore movie along the lines of Bedazzled? Have you written any scripts?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. So last TV script, I did a special for London Weekend with John Cleese and Rowan Atkinson and the various people. Which was pretty good, I thought.
What was that called?
Peter Cook and Company.
And when was that, recently?
Early 80s, I call that recent. One terrific sketch with John as Neville Chamberlain coming back from Munich. It's called Outtakes of History. And we see the full unedited footage of Neville Chamberlain. And I was trying to get him to hit his marks, get his lines right, and say, I have in my hand a piece of paper. But he kept saying, I've spoken to Hertzler and I have in my piece a hand of paper. John was absolutely wonderful. There are three really great things in that show. That was one of them, I thought.
Any plans of another show or something else with Dudley?
Oh, I'll do another show, I suppose. I do really enjoy going into private eye and writing stuff in there. There's no performance involved. Mm-hmm. But the same freedom of being able to think of things on the spot and have them published the next week. But
do you enjoy performing?
Yeah, I enjoy performing as much with one other person or three people in the room as I do on a stage or for TV.
I heard a rumor that there were plans to reunite you and Dudley to do a video of Good Evening for cable television or something like that.
I haven't heard that rumor.
Would you be interested in it? Just to get it down?
Probably, yes. Yes, I'd like to do that.
It's fairly widely agreed by people that have followed your career that your best work has been with Dudley and Dudley's best work has been with you. Do you agree with that?
I think Beyond the Fringe was as good as I've ever got. I mean, but that was with Dudley. And the TV stuff, I've never done anything better. I really can't form an opinion about Dudley stuff because it's a different type of thing. I mean, he's been...
Have the two of you felt a need to prove yourselves apart?
Not really. I don't think it's really occurred to me. It was so comfortable doing television with Dudley. It's hard to imagine feeling more comfortable with another sort of partner. On the other hand, it's very enjoyable to do things here and there, as I was saying with John Cleese or a number of people. But that wouldn't be a sort of permanent thing. I enjoyed our time together tremendously, and I think that comes across in the stuff we did.
What would it take to get another serious working collaboration going with Mr. Moore?
I'm not sure that it would work. You can't tell. I mean, it's a long time since we've sort of worked together, and
as something other than an exercise in nostalgia, which is what the comic.
I'd have thought more likely to be television, and that's unlikely. I think something with an audience and caught me on the hop because I haven't thought about it at all. The experience of just doing one sketch with him for Comic Relief was very enjoyable.
Miss Rigby, Stella, my love, would you send in the next auditioner, please? Ah.
How do you do? Nice to see you. Mr. Spigot, is it not?
Yes, Spigot's the name. Acting's my game.
Right, yes. You'd just settle down for one moment?
Oh, yes, certainly.
Thank you. Mr. Spigot, you are auditioning, are you not, for the role of Tarzan?
Right.
Mr. Spigot, I couldn't help noticing almost immediately that you are a one-legged man.
Oh, you noticed that?
When you've been in the business as long as I have, Mr. Spigot, you get to notice these little things almost instinctively.
Yeah, of course you do.
Now, Mr. Spigot, you, a one-legged man, are applying for the role of Tarzan.
Right.
A role traditionally associated with a two-legged artiste.
Right.
And yet you, a unidexter, are applying for the role.
Right, yes.
A role for which two legs would seem to be the minimum requirement. Well, Mr. Spigot, need I point out with overmuch emphasis where your deficiency lies as regards landing the role?
Yes, I think you ought to.
Perhaps I ought.
Yes.
Yes. Need I say with overmuch emphasis that it is in the leg department that you are deficient?
The leg department?
The leg department, Mr. Spigot.
Yes,
yes, you are deficient in the leg department to the tune of one. Your right leg, I like.
Ah.
Oh, it's a lovely leg for the role. As soon as I saw it come in, I said, hello. What a lovely leg for the role. I've got nothing against your right leg.
Ah.
The trouble is, neither have you. You fall down on the left.
Yeah, it is inadequate.
It is inadequate, Mr.
Yeah.
Spigot.
Yes.
And in my view, the public is not yeti, already for the sight of a one-legged Tarzan swinging through the jungly tendril shouting, hello, Jane.
No, right, right.
But don't despair. I mean, after all, you score over a man with no legs at all.
Oh. I've got twice as much.
Twice as many, yes. You score by 100%.
Yeah, so there's still hope.
Of course there is still hope, Mr. Spigot.
Yeah.
I mean, if we get no two-legged character actors in here within, say, the next 18 months, there is every chance that you, a unidexter, will be the very type of person we shall be attempting to contact telephonically.
Oh.
I'm just sorry I can't be more definite.
Oh.
But you must understand, with the state of the business today,
oh,
what with the dollar sliding and all
you.
That money tied
Good
up
Lord, thank you so much. Thank you. Thank
you. We really can't afford to do everything. Thank you so much. Stella, oh, is Stella with you still?
Now, you said at Comic Relief that the only thing that was getting in the way of a Beyond the Fringe reunion was one reluctant member.
Name that man.
Well, we've narrowed it down to two.
Yeah. It's me. It's me. I'm holding the whole thing up with my giant ego and my demands for silk cushions in the dressing room and a fish tank to look at and three bottles of Remy Martin. I'm holding up the whole proceedings. Yeah, I think it's Alan. But I'm not sure if anybody's asked him. I think they've all assumed he wouldn't want to do it.
Hmm. And if you did it, would that again be the exercise in nostalgia and do the old stuff again?
I think we'd probably do some new stuff. I'd do some new stuff.
Because that's what would be...
I couldn't remember the old stuff, probably.
Well,
I had dinner with Jonathan a while back, and he was quite enthusiastic. I'd like to do it.
What's coming up for you?
No, I'm writing a couple of things. One movie script. I'm very dubious about movies. I can't get carried away with gigantic enthusiasm. I enjoy writing and stuff, but it'd be something I wouldn't be appearing in. I'd just write it.
Have you had a lot of projects that you've had trouble getting made?
No, not really.
No.
The trouble is getting me to do anything.
So
I cannot see the point if one's reasonably comfortably off. I cannot see much point. I don't see the wonderful merit in work. I don't want to be left alone, but and it's nice that people ask me to do things, but unless I enjoy the writing of something, I can see no point in sitting down and thinking, well, I need to think of a half-hour sitcom which will be accessible in America, successful in England.
No, well, your best stuff, and most people's best stuff, is the stuff that they do to please themselves. But it's also been proven that the stuff that you have done most to please yourself, namely the Beyond the Fringe stuff and some of the things with Dudley, is the stuff that has been the most successful.
Yes.
So what would you do to please yourself?
Please yourself? I don't care. I mean, to please myself, I'll go. I think I'll probably just waffle on into a microphone with a sympathetic interviewer and hope that something comes out of it which can be transferred.
Well, Peter, thank you very much for taking this much time with us.
Not at all.
I do appreciate it, and wish you best of luck.
Thank you.
And thank you for...
And by the way, my wife, Beryl, is available for anything, really. But as I said earlier, showbiz is in her blood, and if you like, you can have some of her blood and put that in you.
Good evening.
You've got enough of it. Good evening, thank you.
And that's going to have to wrap it up. That's our three-part series on Peter Cook. I do hope you enjoyed it. Let's see, for the next two... Well, before I get to that, there's people to thank. I'd like to thank John Cleese, Jerry Adler, David Wilkinson, and especially Peter Cook for putting up with all of my questions. I hope you enjoyed the show. The address is Bob Claster, Funny Stuff, KCRW, 1900 Pico Boulevard, Santa Monica, California, 90405. Did you get that? And for the next 2 weeks, baseball stuff, because we're getting towards the World Series and the playoffs. So until then, this is your host, Bob Claster, thanking you for listening and reminding you to always keep that sense of humor well exercised, because you never know when you're going to need it. Have a great weekend, everybody. Bye-bye.